Would you turn in your New Testaments to the Epistle to the Hebrews? The Epistle to the Hebrews. It's good and altogether profitable for me to be here and to be able to share with those of like precious faith in a time of worship and mutual exhortation. It's a special delight to have those who are visiting with us, and no more delight do we know than the presence of the Ephraim Perez family, who are close to this church because of the fellowship in the gospel that has been had between Christians here and Brother Perez for some time. He's just passing through on his way to another place. Reminds me of another man who had a passion to go to Spain. It was a long time ago, and he was not so young as Brother Perez. But there burned in him a concern for lost people that just never could be quenched. And he wrote to the church at Rome that he wanted to come to see them for the first time. But he looked beyond Rome. He said, "I hope to go by you to Spain." And of course, you know who that man was. And we rejoice that the same spirit is alive in gospel preachers today to reach out to new places. Brother Ephraim will be leaving behind those and his family that are dear to him, some, at least one, I believe, of his immediate family. And that goes for his wife as well, to go to a new place. And he'll be speaking to us in the next hour about his plans. And we anticipate with no little delight hearing about that. And to think that we might be able to have a part in such good work. It is a distressing thing to see Christians weakening bit by bit, step by step. They still, in many cases, come to assemblies like this, but it is evident that something is happening that is not good, that is not promising. We have occasion to witness the sad spectacle of men and women who have served the Lord with distinction in years gone by. But then we have to hear the news that they're no longer doing that, that they've fallen away to one kind of difficulty or another, to one kind of temptation or another. And I suppose, as much as it distresses us, it cannot surprise us. The Lord has told us that it would happen, that some seed will not go very deep. And sown in rocky ground, the rising pressures and temptations of the world will cause it to wilt and to die. But as much as we know that it is bound to happen, and as much as we use that understanding to keep ourselves from being discouraged, yet we are concerned. We don't want anyone to fall away from the faith of Christ because of our failure to encourage and to exhort and to teach and to be of help. This epistle that we're going to look at this morning was written to Christians whose faith was failing. Now, some are going to think that that's a rather distressing subject to begin a new year with. Talking about failure? Well, I don't want this lesson to be about failure. I want it to be about success. I want it to be about evaluation and consideration. We are beginning a new year. And we take this time traditionally, and I'm not saying that we just manufactured it. There's something about the passing of time and significant marks in the passage of time that cause us to stop and think. We certainly begin to think about how old we're getting. I sense that sort of sentiment in us every time a year passes, especially a birthday. We begin to think about how old we're getting when we ought to be thinking about how much good has been done to us and how much we've received all these years and be grateful to God for that. I suppose there's no other occasion when people are more open to reevaluation of their lives than the first of a year, unless it is a time of crisis in their lives when everything seems to be falling apart, and then we're perfectly willing then to sit down and say, what did I do wrong? What's caused this to happen? Why am I in this position? And then we get very introspective and we look inside and we say there's something amiss here. Well, I'm not trying to suggest to you today that there's something amiss. I'm saying to you we ought to look and see if there is. The life that's not examined is not a life worth living. We'll never know the directions we're taking unless we are concerned about those directions. And unless we look to ourselves to see whether we're in the faith. We don't want to go to sleep, to become dull of hearing and indifferent to the great thing to which we've been called in Jesus Christ. We don't want that to happen to us. And so for that reason, it is imperative that we stir one another up and we ask some probing questions. If you didn't like last year, this year is going to be just like it. The same passage of time, the same months, the same procedure. Years don't change. People change. It's our task and our responsibility to make this year what it's going to be within ourselves, within what we invest. And I am confident of this fact that so far as your speaker is concerned, if he makes no plans to enlarge himself, if he makes no plans to check certain tendencies in his life that are leading him away from God and away from heaven, then there's no possible way that that's going to happen. As our brother very appropriately spoke to us on Wednesday evening, without plans to change, there'll be no changes. And it's not enough just to meditate. It's not enough just to contemplate. It's not enough just to analyze. It's only enough to use our understanding of where we are in our relationship to God to make a difference. And we can do that. And I'd like for this to be your reaction to the lesson that we're going to be engaged in studying this morning. When you go away from here, I hope you will say, I can do it. There's no reason for my faith to fail. There's nothing too enormous out there that I cannot, with God's help, overcome that. This epistle is addressed to Christians and is talking to them about faith. I thought that's something that you talk to unbelievers about. Well, it certainly is that. But it's also something evidently we have to talk to one another about. It's something that Christians need to be addressed about. And he does that here. There is perhaps no New Testament book that is a greater apology for faith in Jesus Christ than is the book of Hebrews. There is no declaration of the majesty of his deity, no declaration of the wonder of his humanity that will excel this one that is presented by this unknown writer in order to save the spiritual lives of a group of Jewish Christians, who it is obvious from what is said here were flagging in their faith and were about to fall away, and he's reaching out to them to rescue them from disaster. When you think about how the church began, it's hard to imagine Jewish Christians in this state of mind. That first sermon on Pentecost, 3,000 responded. And from among the priests many came, people who were intimate with the affairs in the city, who have known something of the machinations of the Jewish hierarchy and how they had conspired to destroy Jesus, of the jealousy and of the lies and the deceit that went on. But there were many more of them who would have perhaps known nothing about that at all, who had occasion just to watch these events and to judge for themselves who he was. And in spite of the fact that the established religious power in that city was against him, had declared him to be a criminal, had engineered his death at the hands of the Roman, in spite of all that, these 3,000 came and said, "We believe." And then they got to be 5,000 men alone, and the church grew. I know that's a small number from thinking about the whole population of the city of Jerusalem, and certainly compared to the population of the world, even in the first century. But still we thrill to the story, and we recognize here the expression of faith and confidence and a sacrificial faith. At last they had to endanger their lives in order to continue this kind of commitment. Stephen was stoned to death, and they got the message that it could happen to them, but it didn't deter them from going everywhere and preaching the word. Nothing stopped them. They suffered persecution, if not martyrdom. And they were so deeply committed to the truth that Jesus Christ is Lord that they were not going to be stopped at any point. As they spread across the world and the gospel went like a prairie fire from place to place, and they fanned the fire until a startling thing happened in that first century. So startling was it that even historians who had no interest in such spiritual matters had to take note of the movement. And so significant was it in the city of Rome in the 64 A.D. that Nero found these Christians who were then present in very obvious numbers in the city to be a good scapegoat to stop the rumors that he was the one that set the city on fire. So a lot happened. And it was a Jewish movement at the beginning. And a lot of Jews still received the gospel in the Gentile cities wherever preachers went to teach it. The early disciples endured first the onslaught of opposition and excitement of faith and courage. They were not turned aside, but then the next generation came, and I think it's the next generation that this letter is written to. The next generation came, and they didn't have quite the earnest zeal and view of Christ in their hearts. They didn't see him with that pristine glory that the early disciples seemed to have. Maybe it was because they expected the return of Christ. 2 Thessalonians gives us some impression that there were many Christians who anticipated Jesus to burst upon the scene of history rather rapidly. And so, you know, most of us can give ourselves an explosion of activity as long as we think it's going to be something not too long. We had performed some great heroic acts as Christians if we thought that would do it, and it wasn't going to have to go on and on and on. I don't know if that was the reason for this. But perhaps some of that misguided excitement, at least misguided in the sense it was based upon a misunderstanding. It's obvious he didn't come, and then these Jewish disciples had to suffer some taunts from their national brethren. And maybe some of the things that were said to them sounded like this: "Here is our law, brought down on Sinai's summit by God himself, written on tables of stone by God's finger, received by Moses, preserved for generation after generation. This is our law. Where is your law?" And maybe they could bring in a copy of one of Paul's letters, or maybe they had a copy of one of the earliest records of the life of Christ. And maybe they didn't when this epistle was written. Sometime before we judge the destruction of Jerusalem, it's in the 70 AD, it's almost inconceivable to think that this epistle would have been written at a time when all the sacrifices had stopped and the temple was no longer standing. Because it is a great contrast between the glories of Christ and the former glory and the lesser glory of the law and the system that had come before. Now, they were going to receive a crushing blow, those who had any kind of affection for the old system. They were going to see the city destroyed, razed, turned to rubble by an invading army that had no concern whatsoever for the sanctuary of God. And they stood in the holy place with all their corrupting influences, and they denied its importance and significance, and they crucified until they ran out of crosses. That time hadn't come likely when this epistle was written. And so it was a time when their Jewish neighbors could say, "Well, I see you found a wonderful thing here. What have you got?" The New Testament hadn't been written. I mean, you didn't have the Gospel of John or the three epistles of John or the book of Revelation. It's possible even that some of the Gospel records of the four Gospels hadn't been completed besides the Gospel of John. But nonetheless, they wouldn't have been able to have all this tangible history behind them, this long-standing message. It was still being spoken, still being written down. I don't want you to have the impression from what I'm saying that the gospel was not available in its fullness in the world. What I'm telling you is that it was still in the mouths of inspired apostles and prophets. And it hadn't been collected together as we have the New Testament. But it was there in the world. The gospel was preached, says Paul in the first chapter of Colossians, to the whole world in his own day. There's no question of that. He said, I shun not to declare unto you the whole counsel of God. And there's no question but what they had it. But I'm saying it would have been a bit difficult for them if they were challenged to present some tangible something. Long history didn't have it. They were new. It was a new message. Just come into the world. And they might have been challenged by something like this. Here's our temple. Great pride in that building. That had been built first by Solomon and then destroyed, rebuilt by the people of the restoration, and then enlarged, considered by Herod the Great. And they were just very much impressed by it. Here's our temple. Where's your temple? Or they might have said something. Here's our city of the living God, Jerusalem. Been here for years, ever since David made it his capital. Where's your city? Or they might have said something like, here are our priests that go daily through their responsibilities here, dressed in the proper garb of the priest, distinct and special. And here our sacrifices offered to God morning and evening, regularly, according to God's edict. Here are our priests and here are our sacrifices. Where is your priest and where are your sacrifices? What would you have said? I can tell you something. If they had not had a deep and abiding faith in the unseen realities of which this book speaks, they would have been shaken, and evidently were being shaken. So much so that there was an inclination to go back again to that which they had formerly been. And to seek refuge in that tangible, visible system of faith that they had known before. Well, the 10th chapter of Hebrews speaks to the need of these people, beginning in verse 32. But call to remembrance the former days, in which after you were enlightened, you endured a great conflict of sufferings, partly by being made a gazing stock, both by reproaches and afflictions, and partly becoming partakers with them that were so used. For you both had compassion on them that were in bonds and took joyfully the spoiling of your possessions, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and an abiding one. Cast not away, therefore, your boldness, which hath great recompense of reward. For you have need of patience, that having done the will of God, you may receive the promise. For yet a little while, he that cometh shall come and shall not tarry, but my righteous one shall live by faith. And if he shrink back, my soul hath no pleasure in him. But we are not of them that shrink back to perdition, but of them that have faith unto the saving of the soul. He quotes from Habakkuk and reminds them that those who are going to be redeemed, that those who are going to survive, are those who have faith. To endure, not just for a day, not just for 2 days, not for a month, but for as long as is necessary, that faith holds and grows and deepens. He said, that's the individual who's going to be redeemed. And that was their need. The beginning of chapter 11 says, now faith is assurance of things hoped for, a conviction of things not seen. Faith, by definition, is a confidence about things that we cannot see, cannot display, have no tangible material reality insofar as this present time is concerned. And you know, that was their problem. And after all, when you look around and you see all the things that are visible and you can smell and taste and touch and enjoy, and we have a lot of that. We have more than we know of that. We are bombarded. Our senses are continually bombarded in this generation, perhaps as much as any other generation. I know good and well this has got to be the most wealthy generation in human history. I'm not saying everybody is enjoying the wealth in this country even. But I'm saying that many of us have never been so full of things, never been so fully entertained, never been so fully titillated by all the things that are susceptible to the senses. We're just absolutely overwhelmed and overcome by it, so that in the final analysis, the challenge that those Christians had, that's our challenge too. That's our problem too. How do we hold on to faith in unseen realities when we're in a world where things that can be seen seem to be so real to us and have come to govern our lives altogether too much? You know, when we first became Christians, and I don't think there'll hardly be an exception in this audience, Christ was very real to us. We could see Him with our eyes in the mind. We could see Him resplendent in glory, having once died for our sins. We were penetrated by that truth. We didn't have any difficulty conjuring up in our minds a sense of His reality. And not only that, but heaven had a glow about it that transcended all the beauty of this world. And heaven was more important to us, heaven was more a delight to us than anything that anybody could possibly present. We felt it. We could taste it almost. We could touch it almost. And as a consequence of that kind of understanding by faith of the reality of Christ and of heaven, we acted upon it. And I'll tell you something else on those occasions. On that occasion when first we came to the Lord, hell was real to us too. We wanted no part of that awful place. We didn't have difficulty conceiving of its horrors. And because we did not want a part of that, we gave ourselves in utter faith to Jesus Christ so that we could gain that eternal heavenly city. And we could see that too. And out of a consideration for a Christ we had never seen, and a heaven we had never seen, and a hell we had never seen, we made a decision to become Christians and to give our lives or whatever else it took to secure for ourselves the right relationship with God in Jesus Christ and an eternal home in heaven. But time passes. And the vision sometimes fades, especially if it's not fed. Especially if all we get is a few repetitious renderings of old shibboleths, the constant circling of the same old truths over and over again without making any progress. A wheel that turns in place. Time goes on, the world that we can see and the world that we can touch and the world that we can taste and the world that we can hear and enjoy becomes real again, present again, and commanding again, saying, this is what's important. And these great unseen things, which once moved us, lose their reality and the power to direct our lives, and then faith makes shipwreck. That's nothing more touching in many ways than Paul's statement in 2 Timothy, when in the throes of his last hours and his utter confidence that he was about to depart, he has to say, Demas hath forsaken me, having loved this present world. The man who once of whom he had written, he is a fellow servant. And you say, this is seeming pretty dour up to this point. Well, I've said all that because this is the message of Hebrews. I've said all that to tell you there is no reason in the world why your faith can't survive. Why we can't catch again the glow of that vision of the reality of Christ. Why we can't be moved with that more than we're moved by the whole world. No reason in the world why that can't be true. And I want you to have a sense of that today. You know, when we look at Hebrews, we're looking at a book that was written to help people survive who are having difficulties and troubles. I think with many of us, we have two problems. First of all, we just get indifferent. We're so overwhelmed in our senses by the world that has such a presence with us that we just become indifferent to greater realities. But then again, there is also a sense of hopelessness that seizes us. I believe I know some Christians, and I live with one that sometimes has a very, and I'm not speaking about my wife, I'm living closer to this one than with that dear companion. And I'm saying that he sometimes gets this notion that maybe he ought not to bother to try again because he's had so many failures. Let me tell you now that is the devil's lie. That just because you fail to reach the goals you have longed after in the past, there's no reason not to try in 1989 again with hope of success. All of us can testify that we have wrestled with problems long and hard that seemed at times not to yield to our efforts, but at last they have yielded. And step by dogged step, we've attained to the position we wanted to attain because we said we wanted it. Try again. It's what Hebrews says. Try again. Don't give up on your relationship with the Lord. Don't turn away from what is the most precious thing that could be possibly possessed. So, how did Hebrews instruct these people who had that problem? What kind of arrangements did God make to strengthen their faith? First of all, He wrote them a letter. Somebody said, is that all? Oh, dear me, that's a lot. I've gotten some letters that I want to tell you something was significant. Haven't you? Words out of the heart of some other human being. Words that gave expression to confidence, love, affection, appreciation. Words that said, you can do it. Words that said, we love you. And they had a material effect upon our attitude, and they had a material effect upon our disposition, and they just made a difference. But this is from God. And letters from God really do have a powerful effect. So the first thing we need to do in order to strengthen the faith that's flagging, and sometimes we're the only ones that know it. I know that I look at people that afterward I learn are having a terrible struggle. It's only afterward that I learn about it, and I didn't sense it at all. And all of us usually, I think, we imagine I'm the one that's having the struggle. None of these other people are having a struggle because I look at them and they're just going through swimmingly. They're just gliding through this and they're not having troubles like I'm having. Let me just disabuse your mind of that. Everybody here has his struggles. The strongest among us has his struggles. And there's an answer to that. And the most important thing that we can say here is you need to know more about God. You need to study and to read. And that will make a difference. Well, what did he write to them about? He wrote to them about the Lord. He gave them a vision of Christ. I want to tell you that the reason that many of us are failing, the reason that many of us we're hemorrhaging to death spiritually. We've got an internal hemorrhage that drop by drop is taking the spiritual life out of us. And we experience it in this way. We feel no joy in being God's children. We are dragging ourselves through. We feel no sense of anticipation of the future. Heaven doesn't attract us or draw us. We don't think about it much. Our problems are the things that dominate our minds. Our disappointments dominate us. And we're not thinking about Christ and His greatness. And you lose it if that happens. But you read the first chapter of Hebrews and you're reading a picture of great majesty. He says that God, who spoke by many methods and by many men in the past, has in this last age of human history, when everything is going to be wrapped up, when everything is going to come to completion, God has opened His mouth and He's spoken not by the prophets, and not in bits and pieces, but in the fullness of His reality, in the fullness of all His truth, He has spoken by His Son, whom He hath appointed heir of all things, and by whom He made the world. And even as He speaks about His majestic position in the scheme of things here, He talks about the fact that He made purification for sins and has sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high. Greatness, immensity, power. We get away from that. Listen. All things are subject to His feet.
They have been put in submission to His will, things present, things to come, things visible, things invisible. He reigns in absolute power over the wholeness of the universe. And He's the one that holds the worlds together. But we will know that only because somebody tells us that and tells us that and tells us that. We haven't seen it.
But you know that. That works in everything. The only reason I believe that there are certain cities in the world is because people have told me about it. I've read about it. The only reason I believe that certain characters inhabited history, I didn't see them. No way I could have. I might see some of these cities if I spent the money to go and experience them for myself. But the most of them I will not see, and I have this concept of the world that I have not seen in my mind. And I certainly believe in many historical figures that I never saw, you never saw, but we believe them because we have read the reports of them from those who are witnesses of these things. And so when we want to strengthen our faith, we need to hear it again. Somebody said, I've heard that before. I know you've heard that. I've heard it before too. But it has grown dim in my mind. And I've forgotten some of the great arguments that were made by biblical writers that I can't begin to answer. Arguments that sustain the proposition that Jesus Christ is Lord. And there's no other way it could be. We sometimes forget the great truths of that empty tomb and the fact that there's no way to explain that. Cannot be explained by any rational means except He was raised from the dead. And the gospel just hems people in with that message.
But it's easy enough to forget about that.
With the passion to make a little more money. With the desire to have a little more fun. With the desire to have another pleasurable experience. This is very real. These seen, felt, heard things. And we need to see the Lord. And some of us not seeing Him very well are thinking about Him very much. That's one reason. That's one reason why your faith is slipping away from you and your life is slipping away from you. Everything important, precious, slipping away from you. So see the Lord again. And not only see Him in the majesty of His deity, but see Him in the wonder of His gracious love in becoming flesh in the second chapter. That's told. The story is told there. Writer says that the Lord didn't subject the world to come to angels. It was to men that He subjected that world. It was to Adam that He said that He was to rule over the world, to subdue it. And the 8th Psalm speaks about that, but then the writer of Hebrews said, we don't see it that way now. Man is not ruling. But he said, I'll tell you what we do see. Verse 9, we behold Him who hath been made a little lower than the angels, even Jesus, crowned with glory and honor. Because of the suffering of death, that by the grace of God He should taste of death for every man. And then we learn from this chapter and succeeding chapters that He tasted, He became man, He became a partaker of flesh and blood, first of all, so that He could die and become a redemptive sacrifice for us, and second of all, so that He could become a perfect high priest who understood our frailty. We need to read this story again. We need to get close to it. The reason we're failing is because we're not reading. We're not reading the Bible. Let's make a resolve then. We who want to be stronger in faith, we who have not died already, so indifferent that we just don't care anymore. I can't believe anybody in this audience has that attitude. Let us read. Let us fix our hearts upon the message. Let's take it into ourselves. That has influence on faith. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of God. You won't get it by coming up here and listening to me or somebody else once a week. You won't get it. It will not do the job. I cannot do that. Anyone else who stands in this pulpit cannot accomplish that. It takes the daily taking in the Word. If you're not reading, you're a Christian, you're concerned about your faith, you feel yourself slipping away, then read the Word of God. Make up your mind you're going to spend 5 minutes with it every day. Start with some. Just open the book. I ask you just to do that. Just make up your mind you're going to open the Bible in the morning if that's a good time. Or some other part of the day, you're going to open the Bible. You begin to read. I guarantee you, if you'll start, don't worry about the time you'll spend because your mind will be caught there. But open the book.
That's the provision the Lord made. He wrote a book to these people, wrote a letter to these people. Now the second thing we need to appreciate is that he talked about prayer. And this was talked about in connection with the greatness of Christ in the 4th chapter, verse 14. Having been a great high priest who hath passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we have not a high priest that cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but one that hath been in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore draw near with boldness to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and may find grace to help in time of need. We fail, our faith fails because we don't pray. Somebody says, you mean we ought to pray for faith? Yes, you should pray for faith. Will that get you faith? Well, not alone. Not apart from the reading of God's Word, but I tell you, we need to complete the cycle. As we listen to Him, we need to speak to Him. There is perhaps no more informative a name for God than that which is given in Psalm 65, verse 2, O thou that hearest prayer, to thee all flesh shall come. The one who listens and is ready to hear, we're not nearly so disposed to speak to Him as He is to receive what we have to say. The 29th chapter of Jeremiah. There's a very moving statement by Jehovah to His people. Look at verse 11. For I know the thoughts that I think toward you, saith the Lord, thoughts of peace, and not of evil, to give you hope in your latter end. And you shall call upon me, and you shall go and pray unto me, and I will hearken to you. And you shall seek me and find me when you shall search for me with all your heart. I'm here waiting for you. Won't you come and speak to me about your problems, about your difficulties, about your needs? Won't you come and give expression to the fullness of your heart in my presence? This is a great God. Who has ever had a God like this? Ere you left your room this morning, did you think to pray? In the name of Christ our Savior, did you sue for loving favor as a shield today? When your heart was filled with anger, did you think to pray? Did you seek for grace, my brother, that you might forgive another? You know, our tragedy is that we get into trouble, and the last thing as God's people we think about doing is praying to Him. And it ought to be the first thing. If I were to urge you to make a resolve this year, this is one of the important ones. I'd say resolve to pray daily. And not just at mealtime. That is a good time to pray. But resolve to pray personally every day. And the beginning of the day is a good time. Because if you can get it down then, you can get it down the rest of the time. Let the gates of day be opened with an appeal to God. Help me today to do right. Help me today to meet this problem I'm struggling with, an attitude, a disposition of heart and mind. Help me to live with my family like I ought to accomplish what I need to. I need your help and strength. Take the time to unload the fears of your heart. Take the time to express the joys of your heart to Him. He is the God who answers prayer, and He knows His way. He knows His will toward us. Thoughts of peace and not of evil. There's a song that we sing. Oh, for a faith that will not shrink, though pressed by every foe, that will not tremble on the brink of any earthly woe, that will not murmur or complain beneath the chastening rod, but in the hour of grief or pain, will lean upon its God. Lord, give us such a faith as this, and then whate'er may come, we'll taste in here the hallowed bliss of that eternal home. You remember the father of that epileptic boy who was inhabited by a demon, throwing himself about, thrashing about in a very self-destructive way, 9th chapter of Mark. He was brought to the disciples and they couldn't do anything for him. Tried and failed. And then this father said to Jesus,
If thou canst.
If you can. He said, if I can.
And then the Father said, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. We need to pray for faith. And we just need to pray. And another thing, the third thing we want to talk about this morning, then the lesson is yours, is He made a provision for us to grow in our faith by our association with other Christians. That's the thing everybody usually thinks about when we get to Hebrews. And especially, I knew when I mentioned Hebrews 10 this morning, everybody said 45. That's not the message, but it's a part of it. Hebrews 10:24. I love 24. And let us consider one another to provoke to love and good works, not forsaking our own assembling together as the custom of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day drawing nigh. You see, they had a problem in these Christians. And you can read about the problem. Every now and then, the writer of Hebrews will stop to give an exhortation. What's the problem? Negligence, chapter 2. How shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? And in that connection, he said, if we let these things slip away from us, these are drifting disciples, they are slipping saints, and it's happening bit by bit, step by step, slowly, undramatically, the spiritual life is draining out of these people, and neglect is the problem. He said, we've got to challenge that. What else? Unbelief. Verse 12 of the third chapter, take heed, brethren, lest there shall be in any one of you an evil heart of unbelief and falling away from the living God. And what else? Well, he says in verse 13, but exhort one another day by day, so long as it is called today, lest any one of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Hardening of the heart. That callous to the soul that comes in to make you insensitive to the real perils that are facing you, and insensitive to the solutions that are there, to the greatness of God to help you. And then, just simple failure to grow. In the fifth chapter, verse 11, of whom we have many things to say in hard of interpretation, seeing you become dull of hearing. For when by reason of time you ought to be teachers, you have need again that someone teach you the rudiments, the first principles, the oracles of God. And so these were the problems. And the answer is faith. And that's what he's talking about here in the 10th chapter in verse 19. Having therefore, brethren, boldness to enter into the holy place by the blood of Jesus. But they had to know about the blood and they had to think about the blood before they could have this, the power of this exhortation have any effect on them. By the way which he dedicated for us a new and living way through the veil, that is to say his flesh. And having a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart. In fullness of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience, and having our body washed with pure water, let us hold fast the confession of our hope, that it waver not. What is the purpose of this epistle? To get people strengthened in faith. What's the purpose of Christians coming together to strengthen faith? And some of us think, well, it's just a duty. And so we say, since it's a duty, we want to do what we have to do. What can we do here at Douglas Hills to keep from being scandalized or people saying, we're not going to put up with this anymore? How little can we do so that people will tolerate it? Is that what you want to give to the Christ who died for you? Does that satisfy the need for a growing faith? How many times do you need to get together with Christians? How many times do I need to get together with Christians? As many times as it's necessary to have a fullness of faith. And a constancy of faith and a steadfastness of faith that gets me through every trial and difficulty. That's how many times I need to be here. And we have these silly arguments about, you know, well, I come for the Lord's Supper. That's only assembly that's spoken of. I've got to be. That's only one. Dear brother and sister, where is your mind? And all the while you're making these arguments, if you testify to the Lord and the trueness of your heart, you would say, Lord, I am sinking, dying by degree. I have no faith. I have no commitment. I can feel myself slipping away. I can feel the world getting its claws into me. I'm very much aware of it. Why do we make those kinds of arguments? Deceitful self-justification. We need to be together with Christians so that our faith can grow. I know what the church in Jerusalem did, so do you. They were together daily in the temple. How many times do we need to get together? I know the elders of every local church guide the church in deciding those issues. But I tell you, we need to be together enough that our faith grows day by day. We need to be together enough
so that we strengthen one another and provoke one another to love and good works, so that today I'm stronger than yesterday, and so the future days I'll be growing up in the Lord in all things. That's exactly what needs to be done. That's the purpose of it all. Unfortunately for many of us, it's still just duty. Why does the writer speak about this? Because of the symptom that it represents. Not because, oh, you sinned against the Lord because you missed an assembly. It's not that that's a concern to this writer. His concern is that it is an expression of a failing faith. And if he says it's an expression of a failing faith, then it's an expression of a failing faith. Let's just face that. I know that coming to all the assemblies of this church will not take you to heaven, but let me tell you something. Failing to come to the assemblies of a local church will send you to hell. Oh, you say, because we have missed an assembly. Oh, we've committed a terrible crime. No, my dear brother and sister, because you have stripped yourself naked of every defense against Satan. Because you have no strength in your soul to meet the problems that are going to confront you day after day, and in your family, and in the working place. Faith is the concern here. A strong and vibrant and confident faith that enables you to overcome the brink upon the brink of any earthly woe. And then sometimes I think we fail to remember that we come together to help each other. You know, there are three levels of development in the physical world. And that's, first of all, somebody's got to feed you. And then secondly, you can feed yourself. And third of all, you can feed somebody else. And some of us never get past that first level. We've got to come down here and we've got to be fed. And that's the level at which some people, they come feeling a need. They come feeling a need in this assembly. And they come saying, help me. And if they get some help, they'll continue to come. But if they don't like, the sermon did not particularly address their need, and they didn't find any satisfaction in that, and the songs just didn't strike their hearts like they felt they should, and the prayers didn't help them, if they just feel that they just don't come. But what about the needs of others? Let me say this. I do not find it to be characteristically true of people who come to assemblies very negligently, who come in here on Sunday morning and take the Lord's Supper and wave goodbye and leave. These are not the people that are out on the streets talking to people about their souls. These are not the individuals that are here at this building trying to do anything they can. Clean it up, the simplest kind of task. Teaching in the Bible classes. We know who we are. We're hanging on the fringes. We feel our hearts dying, drying up and sniveling. Let's face that fact. It's heaven and hell that are at stake in this thing. And we've got to remember that in connection with our coming to these assemblies. We would do this in every other field of life. We'd say, I need some help. They go to the doctor because we feel some need of our, we're not taking care of our health properly and something's not going right. We go to the physician. We need help. And we'll go and seek counsel with regard to our jobs. I'm not doing very well with regard to my job search, and I need some help. I need some expert counsel. But when it comes to spiritual things, when we're in trouble, we don't seek the Lord's help, and we don't seek the help of our brethren, and we ought to. It's an act of wisdom. We need each other. I need you. The Lord made this arrangement to strengthen our faith, and that's the purpose of it. We ought to take advantage of these. Make a resolve. This year, every day, I'm going to read the Bible. We'll read the Bible together as a family. I'll try to read the Bible myself. I'll read something from our Lord every day. That's not too tough, is it? That's not this tremendous, overwhelming kind of commitment that'll just be impossible. Try it. And every day, I'm going to take time to pray. How in the world could I be in tune with Him if I never pray to Him? Never think about Him. Deal with all my problems without any concern for Him. Enjoy all of life without any gratitude toward Him. How in the world can my faith grow in that situation? And number three, make it your resolve to be at every assembly here that you possibly can be in order to gain something and to give something. You have something to give here as well as to receive. There's a mutuality in Christ. And so I'm appealing to you to think about this year. Of course, there's no one that I'd love to appeal to more this morning than the one who's never said that Jesus Christ is Lord. He's never committed his life to Him. To these great unseen realities. You've not come to a mount that might be touched, says the 12th chapter of Hebrews, but you've come to the heavenly city. You've come to an innumerable host of angels. Can you see them? You can't see them with your eyes. But out beyond you in a world you cannot see, there is a host of angels, God's messengers, who though themselves being like a flame of fire are nothing compared to God and to His Son. We've not just come to an innumerable host of angels, but we've come to God who reigns above all. And we've come to Christ and to His blood that speaks better than that of Abel, that speaks of redemption instead of condemnation. Can you see those things? If you can see them this morning, and if you're willing to commit your life to these great unseen realities, by faith, and please come and make that commitment by obeying the gospel. And to those of us who need to change our direction because we're concerned about that, make these resolves. And any others you can think of that'll help you serve the Lord better. This year is going to be like 1988. If we